This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
Clearly, one of the reasons is to cause mayhem and to torment the civilians, which now we see not only in Burkina, but across the Sahel and Chad basin regions, especially in the last 2 years.
That was UN Refugee Agency spokesman Boris Cheshirkov on recent violence in Burkina Faso and speculation on what sparked the attacks in three different regions. This story and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Our top story today, tensions continue to rise between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Internationally supported negotiations have stagnated, and Egypt has said it will respond to any threats to its water supplies, raising concerns of possible conflict. The United States tried to mediate in 2019 and 2020, but those talks collapsed. Now the U.S. is trying again. VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi has more.
The U.S. envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, is visiting Egypt, Sudan, Eritrea, and Ethiopia this week as part of Washington's new push to resolve the dispute over Ethiopia's dam on the Nile River's main tributary. He started the trip by meeting with Egypt's president, foreign minister, and irrigation minister. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has warned that Cairo will not tolerate any moves by Addis Ababa that could reduce Egypt's share of water from the Nile because of the Grand Ethiopia Renaissance Dam. He urged the U.S. to play an effective role to settle the dispute. Feltman was quoted as saying, "President Joe Biden is serious in settling such a sensitive issue." Mohammed Nasr Allam, a former Egyptian minister of water resources, told VOA that Egyptian authorities think Ethiopia has not negotiated in good faith.
To spend about 9 years negotiating and not end up with any useful thing in terms of operation or in filling. But when the United States intervened, they facilitate meetings and they end up with almost common conclusions by the three parties with very good scenarios for filling and operation, and also go through legal framework as Egypt and Sudan requires, as well as some item for conflict resolution during the implementation of this agreement.
Ultimately, however, Ethiopia declined to sign the agreement, although it has offered to continue negotiating and has asked the African Union to join mediation efforts. The Ethiopian dam sits astride the Blue Nile in Ethiopia, where the river originates before flowing into Sudan to join the White Nile, forming the Nile flowing north through Egypt. The dam's hydropower generators are expected to provide electricity to 60% of Ethiopia, which Addis Ababa sees as crucial to lifting millions out of poverty. But in Cairo and Khartoum, there is fear that the dam could reduce their water supplies, especially in Egypt, where the Nile supplies 90% of fresh water. Allam said Egypt and Sudan have deep concerns about the risk that Ethiopia's dam cuts their Nile water quotas. Under a decades-old agreement, Egypt gets 55.5 billion cubic meters and Sudan gets 18 billion cubic meters. That allotment allows for 500 cubic meters per person in Egypt, about 50% of the water poverty index determined by the World Bank. Sudanese officials have said the filling of the dam this year is a direct threat to Sudan's national security. The Ethiopian ambassador to Egypt, Marcus Tekeli, disagrees with that assessment.
Our focus is on filling and in operation of the dam. If it's about water quota, Ethiopia repeatedly and equivocally made clear that this dam will not cause significant harm. Therefore, I don't know why it become an existential threat, or either in Sudan or in Egypt right now.
Egypt and Sudan say a legally binding agreement on filling and operating of the dam should be reached before Ethiopia starts the second phase of filling. Ethiopia, however, says it will complete the process in July with or without an agreement. David Darush, an associate professor at the Near East Center for Strategic Studies, describes such a position as a provocation for an escalation.
That's really discouraging because basically that's sort of the absolutist statement. Ethiopia here is saying what's in our country is ours, and whatever we allow to go downstream, be happy for it. And unfortunately, the Ethiopian position is one that greatly concerns Egypt. Egypt is so dependent on the Nile, they can't just grin and bear it.
Egyptian President El-Sisi has repeatedly called on Ethiopia not to affect Egypt's share of the Nile water, saying all options are open, and stressing that cooperation is better than fighting. Ambassador Tekle told VOA his country is cooperating and has compromised by extending the time to refill the dam from 3 years to 5 to 7 years. But he said water quotas can be discussed later.
We know about water quotas. We didn't have any such kind of agreement in the past. Therefore, we are not talking about it. In the future, we can discuss the topic that you raised.
Alam, the former Egyptian Minister of Water Resources, acknowledges that Ethiopia wasn't part of a 1959 agreement on water quotas, but he notes that in 1902, the Ethiopian king signed an agreement with Britain on behalf of Egypt and Sudan, pledging not to affect the Blue Nile's flow. Professor Darush says Egypt is trying to bring in international powers to mediate and influence Ethiopia to change its position. But he says if diplomatic efforts fail, there is a risk of military conflict over the dam.
Egypt has a very capable military. If they're operating in conjunction with Sudan, they obviously would be able to stage raids in and out. I think you'd have to militarily an aerial bombardment from Sudanese bases without having to refuel.
Ambassador Feltzman's stop in Cairo was the first leg of a tour that includes stops in Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Sudan. Some regional security experts have said if international efforts do not break the deadlock, the Ethiopian dam could end up being the cause of a water war threatening the entire region. Mohammed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Staying with the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia's Tigray region has been ravaged by 6 months of conflict between the Tigray People's Liberation Front rebels and a military alliance of the Ethiopian and Eritrean armies and their associated militias. Now there are fears of widespread starvation as continued violence threatens to disrupt the planting season. For analysis, I reached out to Professor Alex DeWall, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University in Massachusetts. Professor DeWall, thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you. So, first of all, you have been researching hunger and conflict and politics in the Horn of Africa for decades. You've written numerous books on the matter. Looking in the broader historical context, how do you view what's happening now in Tigray?
I've worked on issues of famine, war, atrocity, genocide, etc. for 37 years. And never in my career have I witnessed or documented a situation of such widespread and systematic and utterly brutal destruction of what is essential to sustain life. This is not only a man-made famine, it is a starvation crime on the hugest scale.
Now, a famine has not been declared in Tigray. We spoke to MSF yesterday, and they said that while one indicator, malnutrition, is above the emergency threshold, and emergency is one step below famine, other indicators, such as mortality, were not at the famine level for the people they have access to.
A famine is unavoidable under the current situation. There are, according to the United Nations, between 4.5 and 5.2 million people in immediate need of humanitarian assistance. And of those, about 1 million are receiving that. The majority of those in need and those in gravest need are beyond the reach of international assistance. The people whom Médecins Sans Frontières are seeing in their clinics are those for whom they have some access. They are not seeing the worst situation that prevails elsewhere. And as the weeks go by, that situation will only deteriorate. What is driving this crisis is not drought. It's not locusts. What it is a combination of a war and a determination, starvation crimes by the Ethiopian Federal Forces, the Eritrean army, and the militia from neighboring Amhara to starve the people of Tigray. So what I very much fear, and the evidence is now overwhelming, is that we are on a very steep downward trajectory towards a disaster, the scale of which we have not seen in decades.
And what's the evidence that you have for this deliberate campaign that you allege?
Despite the information blackout, enough information has leaked out about the deliberate destruction of foodstuffs, the vandalization, destruction of clinics, the destruction of employment opportunities, and the level of rape, of sexual violence, is also extremely high, and that is a starvation crime. Many women and girls, because of fear of rape, are unable to do those essential activities, looking for food, going to market, or even going to look for assistance that would keep themselves and their families alive.
Now, I want to bring in the government's view. When your organization first made this allegation last month of a deliberate starvation campaign, they said in a statement to BBC that your allegations are entirely detached from the facts on the ground. They also said it wasn't them, but it was the rebels, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, who are responsible because they attacked Ethiopian army posts last year right before the harvest season. And they also accused the TPLF of deliberately destroying infrastructure while retreating. Essentially, they're saying you're wrong and this is the TPLF's fault. What's your response?
2 points. First of all, regardless who might have started the war, it is a war crime to go around systematically, relentlessly destroying hospitals, destroying food, raping women and children. They had nothing to do with this war and how it started. Secondly, every senior aid official with whom I have been in contact tells me that what we describe in our report is not only true, but the reality is worse.
Last of all, what do you think needs to happen to either prevent a famine from occurring or to mitigate its effects if, as you say, it is inevitable?
The first thing is to allow communication, to let the world see if there is nothing to hide, then why is the Ethiopian government hiding it? Why has it shut off communications, shut down the internet, prevented aid groups from speaking candidly? Let us go in and see what is happening. Let us also then have a ceasefire. It is a war. The government refuses to concede that it is a war. And then let us move to reconstructing the destroyed infrastructure, compensating and providing reparations to the hundreds of thousands, millions of victims of this needless and brutal war.
That's Professor Alex DeWall, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University in Massachusetts. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, you're very welcome.
All sides in the Tigray conflict have been accused of atrocities the Ethiopian government has variously denied and admitted that its troops have committed abuses in Tigray. The Eritrean government has denied all allegations against its forces, but says anyone responsible for sexual violence should be punished. The TPLF has described the attacks before the harvest season as a preemptive strike and has denied accusations of atrocities. The UN Refugee Agency says recent violence in Burkina Faso has killed dozens of people and forced thousands to flee for their lives, adding to the growing number of internally displaced people in the West African country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Over the past 10 days, the UN Refugee Agency says a series of attacks by unidentified armed groups has left 45 people dead and forced 17,500 people to flee their homes. The UNHCR reports gunmen went on a rampage in three regions, burning down houses and shooting and killing civilians. It says they also ransacked health centers, damaged homes, and shops. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshakov says he does not know what triggered the recent string of attacks.
Clearly, one of the reasons is to cause mayhem and to torment the civilians, which Now we see not only in Burkina, but across the Sahel and Lake Chad basin regions, especially in the last 2 years and in recent months, that this has been fueling one of the worst and largest and fastest growing displacement and protection crises in the world.
More than 3 million people are displaced across the Sahel region. Instability and surging violence in Burkina Faso, much of it blamed on Islamist insurgents, have forced more than 1.14 million people to flee their homes in search of safety in just over 2 years. Chair Shirkov says current trends point to more violence to come.
Our teams are seeing an increasing trend of people fleeing towards larger, more secure urban centers. Most of the people are arriving with few or no belongings. Some have been generously welcomed by host families, while others have sought refuge in public buildings such as schools and other temporary shelters. They're in need of urgent food, shelter, clean water, and health care.
Cheshikov says aid workers are registering new arrivals and providing psychological support and shelter. He says the needs are great and funds are too low to meet the task. He says the UNHCR has received only 22% of its $91.6 million appeal for life-saving humanitarian operations this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now in South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa has welcomed a decision by the U.S. government to support a waiver of intellectual property protections that apply to COVID-19 vaccines. This will now be negotiated at the World Trade Organization, where it's hoped an agreement can be drawn up to give manufacturers the go-ahead to make vaccines. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to South Africa's Deputy Director General in the Department of Health, Anban Pillay.
Pillay says the U-turn on the issue by the administration of President Joe Biden is historic. He says South Africa and India have been the leading voices in pushing for intellectual property or IP rights to be dropped.
We're very encouraged to see that the U.S. has seen its way clear to actually support the waiver of the patents relating to COVID-19 vaccines. We think it's an opportunity for these types of products to become more easily available and accessible to the millions across the world who need access to it.
Pillay says he anticipates there will be global acceptance of this call and that Norway and Germany will also now take the stance. Pillay says once an agreement is reached at the WTO, things can happen fast.
I would think globally what should happen next is an audit of which facilities could produce vaccines, as an example. If they had a transfer of technology and if proposals are feasible, you would then have a multiplication of what the current vaccine production sites are globally, which would allow a much quicker access to vaccines for many developing countries. Also, the issue about cost and affordability would hopefully be addressed through those arrangements. So I certainly think there's an opportunity to do that. There are many manufacturers across the world who just need some tech transfer, and they'll probably be able to run on their own thereafter.
Pillay says almost 80% of all vaccines produced today are being accessed by high-income countries.
And low- to middle-income countries have had minimal access. And that's causing huge challenges. I think India has one such example. India took the approach of actually sharing vaccines with many countries during their production. And that obviously had left them behind in terms of the vaccination process. But I think this is a call to countries to review their approach around vaccines. There's a lot of vaccine hoarding as well that's going on. And I think it's important that everyone realizes that we will not be safe until everybody else is safe.
In a recent statement, the World Health Organization says the slow rollout of vaccines, combined with the ever-growing number of new variants, mean the risk of a new wave of infections in Africa remains high. It adds that the continent accounts for only 1% of vaccines administered worldwide, and observers say that situation will have to change if Africa's people and economies are to regain their health. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
In Zimbabwe, a ruling party-led parliamentary caucus and Senate this week passed a constitutional amendment that critics say effectively creates a, quote, imperial presidency, end quotes, from Harare. Eddie Gondo has more on the story.
The legislation called Constitution of Zimbabwe Amendment Bill Number 2 gives the president unfettered powers to appoint judges without parliamentary review and drops a clause from the constitution requiring the president to have a running mate. The bill, which passed by a vote of 65 to 10, had majority support from senators of the ruling ZANU-PF and some from members of the opposition MDC-T party. Together they end the two-thirds majority it required for passage in a development which analysts say hands the president the much-desired dictatorship he has long sought. They say it endangers human rights and the separation of powers in the country. Many ordinary citizens, civil society organizations, and other opposition political parties fought to prevent MDCT senators from joining with the ruling party to pass the legislation, which they say ensures President Mnangagwa's grip on power. The Senate vote was the final stage of the bill before it is signed into law. The amendment states that the president is not required to consult the Judicial Services Commission for the appointment of the judges to the higher courts. The bill also raises the age of judges from 70 years to 75 years. Human rights lawyer Doug Coulthard says it is now up to citizens to resist the amendments, which he says spell doom for democracy.
In the space of just a month, two constitutional amendment bills have been fast-tracked through Parliament, violating all manner of parliamentary procedures and constitutional requirements. And the theme of both of those amendment bills is the consolidation of power in the person of the president and the undermining of virtually every independent institution that we have to provide checks and balances on government, be that the judiciary, parliament, the prosecutor general, and other institutions.
Coulthard says the judiciary, which helps sustain a culture of human rights and democracy, is all but compromised. And he says the collusion of the opposition MDCT with the ruling party is fatal.
Perhaps the most tragic thing about all of it is that this has been achieved by the complicity or the co-option of an opposition that has essentially been installed into parliament by the regime. To understand this, we have to go back to what happened last year, where essentially the courts handed the keys of control to the main opposition MDC alliance, to a tiny faction called the MDCT that had received less than 1% of the vote at the 2018 election.
Political analyst Effie Nguwe agrees with Coulthard, saying that democratic institutions have been usurped.
What we are seeing is a president who is attempting to create a monarchy out of what is supposed to be a constitutional presidency. Amendment number 2 kills the independent judiciary. It dilutes the strength of the legislature by making both arms of government dependent on an imperial presidency. The death of an independent judiciary means the death of human rights.
Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has condemned the development as retrogressive and authoritarian. Dewama Vinga weighs in, saying the amendment
will be the final nail in the coffin of Zimbabwe's shattered international image. There is no country that can claim to be open for democracy, open for business, that shuts down space for separation of powers, for the rule of law, and for the opposition and for citizens to thrive. This is clearly one of the steps that the Mnangagwa government is taking towards a one-party state, to try and criminalize and outlaw legitimate, viable opposition in Zimbabwe.
Meanwhile, in a move which observers say is too little too late, Norris Nyati of the MDCT, led by Douglas Monzora, has resigned in protest over his party's support for the amendment. He says the bill fails to condemn the government's continued persecution of human rights and opposition activists. But the state-run Herald newspaper says the legislation extends a quota guaranteeing 60 seats in the parliament for women and provides for 10 seats for youths. And it says that by allowing the president to name judges, the legislation is in keeping with rules governing the judiciary in many other countries. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabaro, and our editor, Paul Alexander, thank you for tuning in.